ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm your host, Eric Anderson, and today I'm joined by Dr. Howard Glicksman to discuss a recent paper about a mechanoreceptor that was finally discovered more than 60 years after it was predicted. Dr. Glicksman practices palliative medicine and has been a longtime contributor to the debate over intelligent design and evolution, including through his series of articles at Evolution News about the human body, the designed body. Welcome, Howard.
Thanks a lot, Eric. It's great to be with you today.
So, Howard, I'm really excited to have you on the show today. It's always wonderful to have you here and help us learn more about the human body and the amazing systems that exist in our very own bodies. So great to have you with us.
Glad to be back.
So recently, we had an opportunity to meet up at the Conference on Engineering and Living Systems, and you gave a great presentation about fine-tuning and life cycle management in the human body. So this is right down your line here about what we're going to talk about today. So that's great. And also, I think in our prior conversation, last time we talked, I believe we were talking about the persistent median artery. And we talked about how a lot of things have to be just right for a system to function and how the body can sometimes compensate in amazing waves to solve problems.
Yeah, that's right.
So today I want to talk about a recent paper, Renin Cell Baroreceptor, a Nuclear Mechanotransducer Central for Homeostasis by Watanabe et al. And there's some pretty interesting research that they have done in terms of identifying a sensor in the Renin cells. And we want to go through that today, if that sounds all right.
Yeah, that sounds great. You know, as a physician, we use medication that affects this system. It's called the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. And for the last several decades, they've known that there must be some sort of sensor in the kidney that could detect the blood pressure or blood flow in some way, so that will affect the secretion of renin. So much like you have baroreceptors in the main arteries going to your brain and the aorta, they control blood pressure, another system, the sympathetic nervous system. So they've always known that the sensor must be there. The question was exactly how it works. And it looks like they've figured out a lot about it, which is really interesting.
Yeah, they mentioned in the paper that Tobian et al., clear back in 1957, I think it was, postulated that this pressure sensing mechanism, which they dubbed a baroreceptor, which of course just means pressure receptor, that would help control the release of renin must exist. And in the paper, I'm just quoting here, it says, the baroreceptor is a mechanotransducer that resides in the renin cells and is responsible for the sensing and transmission of extracellular physical forces directly to the chromatin of renin cells to regulate renin gene expression. That's quite a mouthful, but we'll dive in today and help our listeners understand exactly what's going on there.
Sure.
I wanted to mention one thing that jumped out at me just as an aside, but an important aside, because when I read about the fact that this mechanotransducer or this baroreceptor, as it was called back in 1957, had been postulated by researchers a long time ago and then finally identified now in 2021, it reminded me a lot of Paul Nelson's approach that he calls design triangulation, which is a design-centered approach. And just briefly to describe what that is for our listeners, Paul says, look, if we have A and B that are observed, and there's a relation between those in the operation, and if we have good reason to believe that that relationship is legitimate, that it's a true relationship, then we have warrant to go looking for C that ties A and B together, even if we haven't yet observed C. And so that gives us a heuristic motivation for going out and doing research and saying, hey, we need to observe we need to find this third thing because it must exist. And so these researchers clear back in 1957 are saying, wait a minute, we can tell that there is a relationship between these renin cells and blood pressure. And so there must be a mechanism that helps to identify and sense blood pressure and then control the release of renin. So this is a really great example of design triangulation that Paul Nelson has talked about and how we can reverse engineer and do design-centered thinking in an engineering-centered approach. And so that just jumped out at me at the beginning of this paper initially. Now, I'm not suggesting that these folks are claiming to be, intelligent design proponents or anything of the kind. In fact, they pay homage to Darwin. They say The renin-expressing cells are essential for survival, perfected throughout evolution to maintain blood pressure. So, but then, you know, evolution plays no part in helping us to understand the system. It's just sort of this unhelpful and gratuitous, all hail Darwin at the beginning. Now we move on and look at the science. So, you know, the researchers did some really nice work here. It's a little unfortunate that they do this shout out to Darwin, but to their credit, beyond that initial shout out, they really didn't attempt to shoehorn evolution into the actual science discussion and really had some interesting insights that they had done from this great research. So I'm excited to delve into that.
Well, so what we're going to get to talk about, you know, which is so important, is actually what renin does and how it does affect the blood pressure. And I think when your listeners hear all the different components involved, it's much more complicated than just renin itself. To me, it's great that they figured this out, but it's no different than figuring out how the beta or the alpha cell in the pancreas detects sugar, mm-hmm. glucose. You know, for years they already knew about insulin and glucagon to control the glucose. They already knew all that these two different hormones together would control the blood sugar, but they really didn't have the exact mechanism at the level of the cell membrane to figure out, okay, how does the cell actually detect the sugar, right? Although they saw the effect, which is this triangulation you're talking about, was the same thing here. I mean, we actually have medications, probably the commonest drugs that are out there for high blood pressure and also very commonly used in heart failure, related to renin and the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. So we've known for 50 or 60 years the system, how it works. The thing that they figured out, or they've come a lot closer to, is exactly how the sensor works at the level in the kidney. Which is fascinating stuff. Anyway, so yeah, you're right. The Darwinian thing is interesting, but I think it becomes even more complicated once you actually get into how it works. And the key thing is, like what I mentioned when I was at the cells, the actual talk I gave was about the respiratory system and how you need a certain amount of oxygen in certain situations. It's the same thing here. The system, as your listeners will hear, is irreducibly complex because there's several components to it, but it's above and beyond irreducible complexity because it actually has to, the blood pressure has to stay within a certain range. You know, so it's like the Goldilocks principle. It's not only the parts, but also somehow the system knowing, quote unquote, knowing what the level should be for survival. So those are all things that everyone needs to keep in mind as we go through.
Yeah, I really like that point that you made. That's really valuable. So let's back up just for a minute, Howard. This may seem like kind of a simplistic question, but I think sometimes it helps to go back to the basics. Why do we need blood pressure? I mean, why is there pressure in this system?
Well, so the reason why, and we need to answer that question, because if you don't understand why we need blood pressure and the components, the factors within your body, the physiological factors that actually control it, then you'll have no understanding how the renin system works. So basically, blood pressure is the force that the blood applies against a blood vessel wall as the blood flows through it. So, think of it like you're holding your garden hose and you turn the water on at different levels and you're feeling that pressure against your hand. So it's the same sort of thing, right? And if there's more pressure, there's more blood flow or more water coming out of the hose. Technically every blood vessel in the body has a blood pressure because blood travels from the heart to the aorta, to the arteries, into the arterioles and the capillaries. It comes back to the heart through the veins. And technically there is a different pressure in each of these blood vessels. But when mm-hmm. we talk about blood pressure, we're talking about arterial blood pressure, and it's the blood pressure that's in the large arteries. It's usually measured at the brachial artery, the inner aspect of your elbow.
Yeah. And that's the medical definition you're talking about there, the medical definition of blood pressure and how we define it for purposes.
Yeah. So what we need is the word arterial. We're talking about arterial blood pressure, not venous blood pressure, capillary blood pressure, technique. So it's, we leave out the word arterial because really what we're talking about is the blood pressure at the arm. And the blood pressure in America is measured in millimeters of mercury. And so most people are familiar with the blood pressure being expressed as two numbers, like, say, 120 over 60. And so the 120 stands for the top number stands for the systolic blood pressure because that's the maximum the pressure will be because that's just after the heart has just pumped out the blood into this confined space. And of course, when the heart pumps, that's called systole. And then as the blood travels down into the tissues and the heart rests, then the pressure will gradually drop down to a lower, a minimum level, which is the diastolic or diastole, because that refers to when the heart's relaxing. So that's how you get the 120 over 60. But a lot of times when scientists talk about blood pressure, they'll talk about what's called the mean arterial pressure, which is the average pressure. So if you have a pressure of 120 over 60, and the heart's pumping at 60 beats a minute. So that, in other words, each heartbeat is 1 second. The systole lasts 1/3 of a second. The diastole lasts 2/3 of a second. So by a calculation, 120 over 60 would mean a mean arterial pressure of 80. Just gave you an idea, you know, just how they talk about
that. So let me back you up even a little bit more though, Howard, because when I ask, you know, why blood pressure, there's sort of, and it's probably so obvious that you didn't even think to respond to my question this way, but look, if I have a single celled organism, you know, an amoeba or something, and then I'm trying to build up through, say, the evolutionary story, if we take that approach, right? And I'm trying to build up to a multicellular organism. The problem, as I see it, is that that single-celled organism has direct contact with its environment, right? It can get its, you know, oxygen and nutrients, whatever it needs. But what happens when we build up to a multicellular organism?
Yeah, so now the problem is, like you've alluded to, is that, you know, the unicellular organism is like a microscopic island of life. You know, it gets what it needs and gets rid of what it doesn't need through the water it's around. But in a multicellular organism like us, you know, with trillions of cells, most of the cells are not at the surface. So you need various organ systems, and you also need a blood supply to provide that information. So as I was about to say, but you caught me on it, I was about to go to, like, the question is, why is blood pressure important? And as we've said, all the cells in your organs need to have enough blood to live. It supplies the oxygen and sugar that it needs, you know, to live. So it's the blood pressure, though, that makes sure that the organ gets enough blood flow, all right? So having too low or too high blood pressure can cause organ malfunction and death. Too low and the cells don't get the oxygen and sugar they need to work properly. Mm-hmm. If it's too high, the blood vessels that carry the blood can burst. You got to remember that, after all, the blood vessels themselves are made of tissue, so they have definite physical limits, just like, you know, the air in your tire or water pressure in a pipe, okay? So a lot of times this is sort of not taken into account by some people who claim that everything just happened on its own, because you have definite material science here. You know, there's actual physical limitations to what those blood vessels can handle. So, but think about when you bend over and you get, you know, you stand up quickly, you get dizzy, right? Mm-hmm. That happens because you've got these factors, you know, got friction and inertia, and in this case, gravity preventing blood from going up to your brain. And the brain can normally manage its blood flow by readjusting its arterioles. But it has limits, like we just said, it's got physical limits. And so if the mean arterial pressure drops below about 50 or 60, which would be like 70 over 40 to about 80 over 50, that's why you get dizzy, because there's not enough blood flow. The drop in the pressure, drop in blood flow has gone beyond the compensatory mechanisms of the brain. And that's why if it doesn't turn around in time, you're going to be lying on the ground, or you got to get down fast. Okay. And on the other side of the coin, if the mean arterial pressure is basically over 170, that's extremely high. That'd be like a pressure of 250 over 130. Either it can burst the blood vessels, or there's too much blood going into the brain, into the capillaries, and that causes too much fluid into the brain, and you can get swelling, and it's like a hypertensive crisis. People can get confused and have strokes, et cetera. So this is why controlling the blood pressure is very important. And finally, I think what's very important, because you'll never understand the renin thing, is you need to understand what are the three main factors, physiological factors in the body that control or affect blood pressure. The first is the cardiac output. How much blood and how forceful is it being pumped out of the heart? So as you can imagine, mm-hmm. you have an artery, it's confined space, the blood's being pushed in there. So that's going to increase the pressure. If the heart's pumping a lot harder and faster and more blood's going in there per minute, the pressure's going to tend to be higher. If it's less, it's not functioning very well, the pressure's going to tend to be lower. So that's the first thing. The second thing is how much blood is actually in the arterial system. Generally, 10 or 12% of the blood in your body is in your arteries. About good 60 or 70% is in your veins. And so this is all a function of how much water you have in your body, how much sodium, et cetera. So your total blood volume in the body sort of has an effect on the arterial blood volume. So if you're dehydrated or you're having you're bleeding from somewhere, like from an ulcer in your stomach, you're going to have less blood in the arterial system and your pressure is going to be low. And that's a problem. And the final thing is when the heart pumps, it sends the blood down the arteries towards the arterioles. Okay, now the arterioles have smooth muscle around them, and they tighten the smooth muscle, which blocks the blood from going through. Because if every time your heart pumped, the blood shot through all the capillaries all at once, you know, first of all, your pressure would be like, you know, 100 over zero, right? Because all the blood would be lost from the bloodstream, and also it would overwhelm the capillaries, and too much fluid would go into the interstitial fluid. So what basically happens is when the heart pumps, the blood goes down to the capillaries, and then some of it goes through into the tissues, and then it bounces back to the heart. hits the aortic valve and then bounces back. So it keeps this ping-ponging back and forth while the heart is relaxing. And each time it goes back down, a little bit of the blood goes through. So the muscle around the arterial is called the systemic vascular or peripheral vascular resistance. If the muscles around those arterioles are tightened, then it tends to keep the more blood inside the arterial system. Whereas if they're very loose, if they're very wide open, then that tends to drop the pressure. So those are the three factors: cardiac output, arterial blood volume, and systemic resistance. The higher the cardiac output, the higher the arterial blood volume, the higher vascular resistance, the higher the blood pressure, and then the reverse. So that's...
Wow. So sounds like a lot of impressive detail there. You should write a book, Howard.
Well, yeah.
And the other thing, you know, just jumps out at me as you're speaking here is that if we want to go from, like we were saying, a single-celled organism up to a multicellular organism, it's not just a matter of getting the circulatory system in place, right? You've got to have the respiratory system. You've got to have the musculature that's going to work with it. The whole thing has to come together kind of all at once, and everything impacts everything. But anyway, that's way too much stuff to cover today. So let's just focus on the renin system. How does blood pressure impact these renin cells? What did the researchers uncover in that regard?
Yeah, so basically, I think we need to first talk about the kidney, you know, kidney function, how that works. And unfortunately, we don't have, you know, diagrams to show, but basically, each kidney has about 1 million nephrons. Okay, so the unit of function in the kidney is called the nephron. And it has to filter a certain amount of water, basically 10-15% of the water from your blood. It's always filtering all the time, okay? So there's something called the glomerulus. It's a very fancy capillary, very specialized capillary in each of these nephrons. So the blood comes in through an arteriole, and it goes through this specialized capillary called the glomerulus, and this is where the water gets filtered. Now, the interesting thing is that normally in all the other tissues of your body, at the other end of the capillary is a vein. Okay, so when the blood comes, this is where all the fluid filters and everything, this is where the exchange of chemicals occurs in all your cells. In your tissues. And on the other side is a vein. So it normally that's less resistance. Okay. So that's why when the actual blood comes through into your capillary from the arterial side, the pressure is usually 30 millimeters of mercury. When it comes out at the other end, it's 15. In the glomerulus, on the other end, it's not a vein. It's another arteriole. So what you've got is a high tension or high stress or resistant vessel on the other end. So more water will come out. You know, so more water gets filtered. So that's how the glomerulus works. Now, these cells that we're talking about, these renin cells, are located right along the arteriole, all right? So as the blood comes in, as it's literally entering into the glomerulus for it to be filtered, these cells are either, you know, they're stretched a certain amount. So if there's more pressure coming in, there's more blood flow, more pressure, it's going to wobble these cells or stretch them more than if there's less, all right? And so this is the mechanoreceptor that you're talking about. So that if you can imagine this you know, this tube of the arteriole, and right along the tube are these little cells that are going to make renin. And so as the blood, it starts, you know, wobbling these cells. But the key thing is that, and this is the thing I found fascinating from the picture they're showing us, is that in between there, you have what's called the extracellular matrix, you know, between the cells and the arteriole, and that wobbling or that stretching of that tissue moves the extracellular matrix, which may consist of collagen or, you know, some sort of fibrotic tissue. But connected to that 90 degrees is something called an integrin, and that integrin actually goes right through the cell membrane into the renin cell. Okay, so that wobbling, the wobbling of that tissue by the arteriole is being translated. That effect is being translated by this integrin. These integrin molecules right into the cell, and that then attaches to another part of the cytoskeleton called the actin, and that wobbles that. Sort of becomes like a Rube Goldberg machine. It wobbles that one, and then those have another 90 degrees to that, another protein that goes right through the nucleus, the nuclear membrane, and somehow connects up with the chromatin and, you know, the gene expression.
Yeah.
If that explains it, you know, that's the best I can.
Yeah, no, that's great. There's a great graph, as you mentioned in the paper, which we can't show, unfortunately, but I think you've done a good job of describing it. Let me just give you a couple of quotes from the paper for our listeners. So our data suggests that integrin beta-1 may represent one of the first steps in a mechanotransduction mechanism in response in changes to perfusion pressure. And without beta-1 integrin, the renin cells cannot respond appropriately to changes in pressure. So this pressure is somehow moving this complex of proteins that are sticking out of the cell, right? They're protruding through the membrane out into the extracellular matrix and feeling that pressure or being impacted by that pressure and then translating that pressure to the interior, which then, as you say, also has to translate even further through another set of mechanisms, which they didn't fully identify. They started to identify it and had some good ideas about where to go next, but ultimately gets into impacting, which I found fascinating, physically impacting the way that the DNA is wrapped, these chromatin fibers, which are about 30 nanometers across. And it's still unclear exactly what the structure is and exactly how this works, but they were able to identify that this pressure sensing mechanism in this membrane is translating that into the cytoplasm, which then gets translated into the nucleus, which then impacts these chromatin fibers of the DNA and impacts the expression of this gene. It's a really fascinating process. And they note in the paper that there's a lot still that's unknown and a lot of great research still to be done here. But the bottom line is that this is a pretty remarkable mechanism that takes this physical pressure and translates it into a decision point about how much of this gene to express.
But the key thing here that we do know, and this is what the listeners need to understand, is that the pressure that experienced by the renin cell and how much renin gets sent out is an inverse relationship, okay? The higher the pressure, the more movement, it must be inhibiting the gene, because when there's high pressure, there's less renin sent out, which we've always known. And they have to figure out, you know, what's going on, but it must be inhibiting the gene expression. Whereas right. when the renin level is lower, right, and there's less movement, then there's more renin sent out. So come up with a Darwinian explanation for that. Never mind all the parts put together here. Don't talk about it irreducibly complex. But the cell somehow must know that when there's too much pressure, it's got to reduce the renin. And here's the key thing, because what I just said, we're going to get into this later about exactly how renin actually does it. The point is, we've just said that the pressure has to stay within a certain range. So somehow there must be a set point within the renin cell saying, okay, at what level does it decide, hey, we got to turn this off. How much are we going to turn it off? How much are we going to turn it up? You know, sort of the dynamic capacity of blood pressure control. You've got to have a set point. It's just like a thermostat with air conditioning and heating. You know, all of a sudden the temperature whips up to 90 degrees, the air goes on, right? Does it say, well, we don't have to do it too hard. You know, it could take 3 hours to get the temperature down to 72, or it's going to really go strong to get the temp down. So, or the other way around. So it sort of works very much like a thermostat. But in this case, as we said, if the pressure's high, then the renin cell has to reduce the amount of renin.
Yeah. So there's some kind of a sort of a, what do we call it? A static or a standard amount that it's producing, but when it senses pressure that's too high, then it starts to cut back on that and have an inverse relationship.
Yeah. So it's usually called like a basal rate. So it probably has a basal rate of renin that it's always sending out. And then it fluctuates, you know, modulates back and forth, depending what the pressure is.
Yeah. No good. So, all right. Well, we have this pressure sensing mechanism, which mediates the expression of this Ren1 gene, but this is just the beginning of a remarkable cascade process. I'd love to have you back, Howard, to tell us more about this critical process that helps control our blood pressure and keep us alive.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. Join us again at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. To help others learn about the powerful evidence for design in the world, please consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.